Hello, this is Sunday Profile with me, Richard Hay. This week, the woman who does sweat the small stuff. Michelle Simmons is a physicist, and she's working on a very small problem with a very big payoff. She's trying to build a quantum computer, which makes use of properties at the quantum level, which is very small. Quantum computers are still only theoretical, but they're machines of astonishing computational power. Whereas classical computers, the ones we use now, have bits which represent either a 1 or a 0, quantum computers will use qubits, which can represent a 1, a 0, or any what's called superposition between those states. Every time you add a qubit, you double the processing power, which is why quantum computers offer such potential, and why there's an international race on to build one. Michelle Simmons is one of the front runners. Her team at the University of New South Wales has already built the world's smallest transistor. And this weekend, because of her achievements, she's in America to become a member of that country's Academy of Arts and Sciences.
It's obviously a great honour. I was completely unaware that anyone had nominated me, so that makes it even more special, to be honest, because I knew nothing about it. But I guess it's recognition of doing something good. So it's always nice to be recognised.
And you're inducted into the Academy about the time we go to air. Although I think there's several days of ceremonies. You have to go to Cambridge, Massachusetts for this, don't you?
That's right, yeah. So it's 3 days of different events, lunches and evening functions. And so I have no idea what to expect right now.
Right. Well, you're a pioneer and world leader in quantum computing. Now, this is the elephant in the room that we have to talk about. What is quantum computing?
Well, so I guess it's a new type of computing where you're, instead of using what we call classical states, which are what we all know as bits, the ones and zeros of digital information, we're using quantum bits. And the view is that instead of being in a one or zero state, you can be anywhere in between those two states. And so everyone says, well, what does that mean? And I guess to put it another way, the way I always like to think about it is if you're in the classical world and you're using classical computing, you have to do one thing after another. So it's like a cooking recipe. You know, you have to add the eggs and then add the flour. But you can't, get to the end of making the cake until you've put everything in one after the other.
It's like a German sentence. You don't know what it means until you get to the end of it.
That's right. You never know what's going to come out. So the advantage of that is that computers nowadays are very fast. So they can go from one thing to another very, very quickly. So, 10 to the 10 operations per second, so it's incredibly fast. But in the quantum world, you can actually, instead of going one by one, you can do everything at the same time. So it's like living in parallel universes all at the same time. Well, one person's adding the eggs, one's adding the flour in a separate universe, and it's all coming together at the same time.
Right. Well, we'll get later into what that might mean. But to do it, you've got to build very, very, very small devices.
That's right.
Literally on the scale of individual atoms.
Yeah.
And that's where your work comes in. So in a few years ago, 2010, you had a breakthrough when you isolated, I think, 7
That's right.
atoms. And then in 2012, you got it down to 1 atom. What's next?
So the irony is, if you look at, again, the classical computing industry, every year devices get smaller and faster. And the money is to try and make them smaller, because the smaller they are, the less distance the information has to travel and the faster they get. And so every year you'll find that, essentially you've got a lot more transistors on a chip and your computer is generally faster every year. With the quantum world, once you isolate a single atom, you've started at the beginning with one transistor. And then what you're now doing is trying to add other transistors to that. So in the quantum world, you're going the other way. You start with the smallest component and then you try and add quantum bits to it. And the more quantum bits you add, the more computational power you get.
In fact, it doubles every time you add a single quantum bit, doesn't
it? Yeah,
that's the astonishing thing.
That's the amazing thing. So I think when we started this project over a decade ago, you can predict as a function of time when you're going to, if everything continues at the same rate and you can keep making things smaller, at what point you would reach a single atom. And that was always going to be around 2020. And so we got into the field because we could see that the technology existed to do that then, so back in 2000, and we just had to figure out how to bring it all together. And so that's really where we've put all our efforts in to try and make those single atoms. But obviously, in the meantime, industry has kept coming down, at the same pace with the view that they will get there at 2020. And so there's this great convergence now where a lot of the research we're doing is really where industry is working. And they're now engaging quite heavily with us as, you know, what is going to be the next step once you get towards that point. And quantum computing is evolving as one of the great applications of getting down to that scale.
Right. That 2010 breakthrough that we just talked about, it's featured in the Guinness Book of Records. But I understand that at first you didn't know that.
That's right. That's right. So I did. I remember, I mean, I get a lot of emails every day, but I remember at one point getting a message and in there it was clear that it had come from the Guinness Book asking for a photo. So I sent them a photo of the actual device and never heard anything about it. And I had so many emails, didn't think about it. And then the next year I came home from work one day and my son was very excited. He'd been to school. And he'd gone to the library and he'd been looking in the Guinness Book of Records. And he loves that anyway. He loves seeing what's the fastest man or the tallest building. And he said, Mum, you're in the Guinness Book of Records. And I couldn't believe it. I thought he was joking. And then he showed me and there it was, you know, the world's smallest transistor. So he was very excited because he actually saw it first. And that's how I found out about it.
Actually, what was the moment like that? Well, the moments when you'd realised you'd built the world's smallest transistor?
I guess it's an evolution because you actually fabricate the transistor and then you measure it. And when you measure it, you can get characteristics out that tell you it is what you think it is. So we made it and everything looked like it was going to be, you know, the transistor that we hoped we'd make it. But it wasn't until we actually measured it that we saw this characteristic signature electronically of what it would look like. And that is honestly, as a scientist, that is just the best feeling ever. I mean, that's why I think scientists get very motivated to do their work.
Dancing in the lab?
It's just this deep inner sense of satisfaction. I can't describe it. I mean, I've had it now several times in my life, but, you know, that feeling when you've had to crack a nut that's really hard to crack, it's taken an awful long time. You never knew if you'd ever get there. And then when you see it, it's just such a fantastic feeling. I can't describe it. It's wonderful.
What do you think explains your centre's success?
I think a lot of it's actually the Australian culture, believe it or not. So I grew up in England and, I went to a very good university. I worked as a researcher in Cambridge and it was, you know, I had fantastic access to equipment. But I tended to find that if you wanted to do something ambitious, if you really wanted to go for something that was long-term and you didn't know if it was going to work or not, it was actually very difficult in the UK system as a young person to achieve that. Whereas in Australia, they have a lot of fellowships for young people, so that you can start getting funds for yourself at a fairly early age. And as long as you're, you know, working hard and producing results, there's that opportunity here. And so that's partly why I came, because I could sense that. And then when I arrived, it just took off. And so there's, you know, that sense of trying to do something difficult, having the support to do it, having the culture with the people around you that they don't say, oh, it's not going to work, why are you wasting your time? There's more kind of, oh, yeah, why don't you try this, why don't you try that?
Really?
You know? So in England, it's very much, if you come up with an idea, that people will give you literally 100 reasons why it's not going to work. In the US, it's very much, we can do anything, but it's, you know, very zestful, but, you know, not necessarily having that kind of discursive nature about what's reasonable, but in a positive way. But it's just it's the inherent can-do optimistic attitude. There are some people that are not like that, but since I've been here, I've certainly found that that's the case.
You've sacked them, haven't you?
I don't have the power to do that.
Well, let's talk about, because the bits of kit that you've got in your laboratory, they're really complicated. $3 million to construct, and you were really, as I understand it, you're connecting two completely different technologies. And that hadn't been done before.
Well, so no, people had tried it before. And so on one side, you're trying to manipulate atoms. So you need minimal vibrations so that you can actually pick them up and move them around. And then on the other side, you want to, once you've manipulated the atoms, you want to encapsulate them. You want to put them in, you know, make it in a structure that you can then take out and use in the real world. So you literally, you coat it essentially with silicon in our case. And so the machine that does that tends to, in order to get really good quality silicon, has lots of pumps on it. So it vibrates at certain frequencies. So to connect those two, essentially they're two pieces of stainless steel with a vacuum like you find in outer space inside them.
It looks like a really evil weapon. No. I've seen the pictures.
It does. It's actually very similar technology to what you send up in space.
Although I saw the last picture I saw, there was also bits of what looked like, I'm sure this is not true, it looked like sort of cooking foil wrapped around bits of it. It is cooking foil.
So typically in order to get very good vacuum, so if you're trying to grow something very pure where you're manipulating atoms, you want to get rid of all the other atoms you don't want in there. And the best way to do that is to create a vacuum and you pump everything else out. And the vacuum that we achieve in those systems is what you would find in outer space. So it's very, very low. But in order to do that, you've also got to pump out the water. So you heat it up like an oven. So you put an oven, literally you put an oven around it and heat it up to about 150 degrees. And you have to protect all the windows with tinfoil so that they don't crack.
Right.
So they reflect off. And then typically what you'll find is you have to do that, you know, a couple of times a year, so people don't bother taking the tinfoil off. So quite often you'll still see it in the lab when you go through it.
So you said people had tried it, but I don't think anyone had achieved it until you did it. And there must have been some concern that it wasn't going to work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So people had tried putting it together, but they found that the crystal growth system vibrated and you couldn't manipulate the atoms. That was the key thing. So we worked with the two German companies who made the two individual systems. We worked with engineers in Australia, acoustic engineers, vibration engineers, that actually designed the whole lab. So that we actually put one system that vibrates along a separate block that's, you know, 10 meters into the ground, different vibrational structures underneath, so that all the vibrations went into the sand rather than the floor of the building. And then we had to connect it together with special bellows and 3 tons of concrete between so that the vibrations wouldn't transfer. We didn't know if it was going to work. And I have to say, you know, in my career, that was one of those decisions. I think it was $3.5 million. We had to put the money up front with no guarantee it was going to work.
So. It's odd, isn't it? Because, you know, you trained as a physicist and you end up being a kind of project engineer for this gigantic construction.
Yeah, that's right. And it's ultimately, it all comes down to, you know, looking at what's reasonable and what's the best you can possibly do and talking to the best people you can. So anything's possible if you really want to do it.
Well, let's talk about what these quantum computers, when we actually get one to really work, what it might be able to do.
Yeah, so look, if you go back to the classical transistor, when they first designed it, they didn't know that they were going to make computers in the long term. And so they were thinking they were going to use it for a hearing aid. That was their first application. And, you know, there's this famous quote that no one can attribute to anyone, but that, you know, at the beginning, there'd only be like a worldwide use for 5 computers.
That's right.
So I guess quantum computing is at that point where, you know, it's probably had about a decade's worth of research in it now, maybe slightly more than that. And at the beginning, people had very strong views that they would be used for very fast database searching. So if you've got to look through lots of things very quickly, a quantum computer can do that in parallel, so you'll get the answer much, much quicker than a classical computer. And then the other application at the beginning was code breaking. So you'd be able to, you know, when you type in your 4-digit PIN code, that's encoded in another large number, and you'd be able to decrypt that easily with a quantum computer. But I think since that time, the thing that's really become clear is that anything that has a large database that you've got to sort through, or anything where you've got to optimize a problem, quantum computers will come in. And if you look at that goes right across pretty much every industry. So the transportation industry, about logistics of how you get goods around the place, how you
this
get
airlines.
This
is the traveling salesman problem.
Yeah, traveling salesman problem.
Which is very famous.
And then, you know, in the medical industry, doing drug design, working out the structure of DNA, how people will interact with certain drugs so you can do personalized medicine. So, again, lots of computational power needed to solve that. Simulating systems. So for us, simulating how you actually build a quantum computer, that's something we actually see already. So, you know, when you have a one quantum bit system and you want to build a 2-qubit system, where do you put the next qubit with respect to the first? It actually turns out that classical computers cannot help solve that problem. It's already too complicated for them. And so the quantum computer is a way of putting the two atoms there and then optimizing where the best position is. So there's this kind of view that the quantum computer will help build. As you increase the size of qubits, you'll figure out how to make it better.
How to make it better.
Yeah.
Well, there's you're just really hinting at the possibilities, and we don't really know, I suppose, what it could do.
We don't know.
It's going to be a very competitive area. I mean, there's governments, and now corporations like Google, I think, are involved.
Yeah.
Who is closest to cracking this?
Ah, so that's a very good question. So I would say we're right up there. So in terms of building a scalable system where you have lots of qubits, one of the key parameters you need is how long can you encode information in a bit and how long will it last as you operate information on that. And so that's something called the coherence time. And the longer that time is, the better your qubit will be. And so we've got results that are going to come out very shortly. Unfortunately, it's embargoed, but then we've got the longest coherence time in a solid-state system. So actually, Australia is really right up there at the front.
Right. You not only do the research and handle the big, you know, building of the laboratory, and I understand you're going through more extensions at the moment, but you talk to industries in Australia about how this technology might be applied in the future. Who are you talking to?
So to be honest, lots of different industries. So pretty much any industry we think it's going to impact. So from transportation, the finance industry. So again, it's something that you can use to optimize calculations, forecasting the economy. So again, talking to financial institutions, talking to defense institutions, you know, anything that relies on high technology and has huge amounts of data. For us at the moment, we're very focused on actually building it and trying to be the first in the world to build it. That's really what we're doing. And I guess along that way, we're trying to let people know of the opportunity as we're getting close.
How close are we then?
our plan at the moment is to build what we call the first quantum integrated circuit, which is a 10-qubit system, which we think we'll do by about 2018. And once you get a 10-qubit system, you have essentially performed all the fundamental functions of the quantum computer, and then it's really more of an engineering issue as to how to scale up.
Mm.
And so that's really where we're at. So 10-qubit system by 2018, and then we would hope to go within the next 5 years from 10 towards 100.
Wow. On Sunday Profile, I'm Richard Adie, and I'm speaking with Professor Michelle Simmons. She's a quantum computing pioneer who's been elected to the prestigious American Academy of Arts and Sciences. When did this begin? When did you discover that science was your thing?
Look, I think from a very early age. So when I was young, I used to actually watch my brother and my father play chess a lot. So this is right, from 5, 6 years old.
Mm.
And it, you know, the games would go on for several hours, and I would just be fascinated that so many. Actually, it's very similar. Any move you made had a whole series of consequences. Very strategic playing, and so I loved it. So from a very early age, I saw that, and I thought, I like things that are difficult, where you have to concentrate for long periods of time.
Right. So you're at school, you're obviously learning science. And I suppose someone listening now actually might think, I bet she had, brilliant teachers at a top school, but it wasn't like that, was it?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. So unfortunately, when I was young, my brother was quite sick. And as a consequence, he missed a lot of school. So when he came at the age of 11 to choose a school, his choices were very limited. He missed a couple of years. And so my parents thought it wouldn't be fair to send me to a better school than him. We should go to the same school. So I actually ended up going to what was essentially an inner London comprehensive school. Which now is no longer a comprehensive school. It's a sports college, I understand. But it was it had about 2,000 students in it. Had a very strict headmaster who would stand on the roof with binoculars and watch out for the fights in the playground because they were always there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I guess the interesting thing for me is once we finished our O-levels at the age of 16, they introduced something called independent learning. And we were really the guinea pig year to try this out, where we'd actually be given books and left in the classroom and told to teach ourselves.
Do it yourself learning. There were not enough teachers?
It's called ILPAC. I don't know who came up with the idea, but I really don't understand it. But they literally, so I did A-levels in maths, physics, chemistry and biology. And they basically would leave us, say, for example, in chemistry, they'd leave us in the room with the books, and there would be this, brown cardboard box with all the equipment to do the experiments that you need to do in the books. And they would have a technician there, so safety was, something they cared about. But the teachers would go out of the room, and so we would go up there, and there would just be this box, and we'd open it up and, see all the bits and pieces, try and figure out how to set it up, and then do the experiment. And, At one level, looking back, I think it was terribly bad that they did that. But at another level, I actually benefited hugely from it because again, from an early age, there was no one around to ask. So I had to figure out how it all worked for myself and taught myself, which again is something, that at some level I fundamentally believe if you really want to understand something, you've got to learn it yourself. You can't just learn it from somebody telling you it. But at another level, it means that you're limited by your own ability at that age, yeah? And so, it's a very interesting combination. It's something I think has helped me.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it would because my own time of doing a BSc, one of the first things you learn when you're doing a BSc is that all the experiments that you have learned, they mostly don't work when you're trying to get them to work for
yes,
the first time.
That's very true.
You're actually spending a lot of your time trying to figure out how you've stuffed it up,
whereas
you did that at school.
Yeah, that's right. So actually, I remember going to university and in contrast to all of my, fellow colleagues at university, they were all desperately trying to get out of going to lectures. Whereas for the first time I had somebody, really telling me things and I remember thinking, that's what they meant, and so all things were connecting together at the lectures. And, and doing the practicals were just great fun because I could really just get in there and get it working quite quickly. So.
Yeah. How are your parents about this? Because, your dad, I think, was a police officer, your mum worked in a bank.
Yeah.
And you're this precocious scientist person.
I don't think they saw me that way. So my father is he was always thinking that I wasn't really getting on with my life. So he would say to me, "So when are you going to get a proper job?" he wasn't impressed at the beginning with my choices because he thought I was like this perpetual student.
Right, which you have to be if you want to be a scientist. For
yeah,
a while.
Also to be honest, if you as a researcher, you really spend a lot of time in the lab. You don't care about what you wear and, you're just focused on getting results. And so, I guess as a parent, you're thinking, you might have an idea your child's going to become a teacher or a doctor or something, and you'll see them going off to work in a professional suit. And so, so I can understand why he would think, what was I up to? But I guess he always knew that I was very happy.
So. Right. So you chose to come here, and you've already talked a bit about why you think it's paid off, because at the time you had a choice. You could have gone to Stanford, which is one of, like Cambridge, one of the world's leading institutions.
Yeah. Well, so to be honest, so when I was in Cambridge, I applied for lots of different things, and they all started coming through. So I had an interview at Stanford, but at the same time, I got the position in Australia. And I'll be honest with you, I actually talked to lots of people about where I should go, but instinctively, I just knew I was going to come here. So that sense of the academic freedom and being able to do something I really wanted to do in an environment where, you know, I felt that there was going to be support, that was really why I came. It was very obvious that was going to be my choice.
I'm sure there are other offers now, particularly from the US. Are you ever tempted to go elsewhere, or is...
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, I honestly, things are going so well with the research here. We're doing outstandingly well. We're attracting the best people from overseas to come and work with us. We live in a fantastic city in Sydney, so, you know, there's no reason I would want to go anywhere else. And the university that I'm at has been hugely supportive.
I was going to ask about that because, you know, we have world-class scientists in Australia, but the funding is not where it has been in the past. And there are people at places like the CSIRO who are washing up dishes because of budget cuts.
Yep.
Do you feel enough supported enough?
Look, I do. So I think, you know, certainly in the research area I'm in, it's a very popular area internationally. And I think, you know, because we made that kind of ambitious step over a decade ago, we are at the forefront. And so, you know, the results that we've got coming out, you know, in some ways they speak for themselves. People will see what we're doing. They can see that we're leading internationally. So from that perspective, when you're in that moment and things are happening so well, you're really, you know, you're focused on, I've got to get this next goal, this next milestone. This is where I'm heading. How do I get there? And you're continually applying for funds to make that happen. And, you know, quite often if you do apply for something that doesn't work out, you just keep going because you know you want to get that goal done.
Your husband, he's in a similar related field because he's an advisor to universities on research strategy.
Yeah.
You've got three kids, I think.
Yeah.
It's a busy life.
It is busy, yeah.
I imagine, though, you don't chat to the other parents about your work in the school pickup if you ever get to do the school pickup.
Oh, no, actually, quite. Yeah, so they, you know, there's quite often sports days or anything else. People actually really like it. So one, I think, yeah, I guess of all of it, the one of the groups of people I like speaking to most are actually young children, so primary school age children, because they love it. And so quite often, I guess through my children, they will talk to their friends about what goes on. Their friends will talk to their parents. And, you know, so they're quite often people will ask about it and they, you know, they get really into it. So
How do you relax? Because I would imagine that this job, it could fill up all the available hours if you let it.
Yeah, it does, absolutely. And to be honest, to be competitive, it has to. So, and so I guess most of my time is spent working or trying to figure things out, making sure I've got everything I need to keep going with the research and for my team and the Centre of Excellence that I'm running. But then I've got three great young children, yeah? And so when I get home, the time is all theirs. Since I get home in the evening, you know, we do homework, we do music practice, you know, do what young children do. And, it's a pure delight to spend time with them.
Yep. Do you get to do anything for yourself? Walking, music?
Yeah, well, so I have to be honest, so for a long period of time, I was very into basketball. And yeah. So actually part of the reason I also came to Australia was I thought it would be easy for me to continue that here. It's actually not been so easy. So when I was in Cambridge, they had a kind of a makeup team that would meet every day at a gym. And it was, you know, still probably about half an hour cycle away. But that was fantastic. I played every day. And when I first arrived here, I tried to find that nearby and I haven't been able to find it. So I have done, you know, lots of swimming and walking just to keep fit, really.
Mm.
But yeah, no, it's really the family and work.
When you get this 10-qubit series of transistors done, will that be it or
no.
Will you think...
No, absolutely not. We're already looking beyond that.
Well, you know, you said before, every time I've kind of moved on, I found something else I'm interested in.
Yeah. Well, so here you go. So that's what I love about the project I'm on, is because it started out with how do you fabricate one? And that's like a project in itself.
Mm.
Then how do you actually make an integrated circuit? That's a completely separate project in a way. It's using the same tools, but actually to get there, we have to innovate completely different way. So it's a completely different challenge. And then to get from 10 to 100 is a whole series of other challenges. And there, so it's new areas that I've never done before in order to be able to get to that. And all throughout that, I guess one of the things I also love is that, you know, I'm not just a physicist doing a little project by myself. I'm having to talk to engineers, computer engineers, software engineers, theorists and mathematicians. And so all the way along, I'm constantly evolving, you know, so I get that sense of, You know, I'm never standing still. Things are always evolving, and I can already see the next stage and thinking, you know, holy smokes, I've got to now learn all of this, and I know none of that right now. And so that's, you know, so even to get, you know, once we get beyond 10, which I can now start to see, you know, I can see the end point, I already see there's a whole load of things that have to be done to get to the 100. And so we're starting to work on that now, and it's hugely exciting.
Sounds it. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Professor Michelle Simmons is the Director of the Centre for Quantum Computation and Communication Technology at the University of New South Wales. And she's just become a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. If you want to listen again or set up the podcast, go to our website at abc.net.au/radionational. The program is produced by Belinda Sommer. I'm Richard Atkin.